On the Against the Rules podcast, best-selling author Michael Lewis takes a hard look at what's happened to fairness in American life. He's explored referees and coaches, and now he's tackling a new group, experts. Michael wants to know, why is a country so good at creating experts so bad at taking their advice? He'll dive into the depths of the sea, swing by the playing field, and venture onto the stock market floor to leave you thinking differently about the experts in our society. Listen to Against the Rules wherever you get podcasts. In 1991, singer Natalie Cole released an album that covered classic standards made famous by her late father, the singer Nat King Cole, who died in 1965. But one track was more than an homage, it was a duet. Sound engineers seamlessly combined vintage recordings of Nat King Cole with new ones of Natalie. And in the video, editors overlay shots of father and daughter, so for a few seconds, it almost looks like they went into the studio together.
That's why, darling, it's incredible that someone so unforgettable thinks that I am unforgettable too.
Many fans loved that effect, a few found it tacky, but it is child's play compared with how digital deepfakes are being used today to literally put new words in the mouths of the dead. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So many of us long for just one more chance to spend time with loved ones who've died that it's not surprising tech wizards are working up holograms and other interactive yet artificial versions of the dead. In the same way funerals are more for the living than the dead, these deepfakes are sometimes pitched as a way to ease our terrible grief. But as the tech keeps getting better and better, it's still worth asking whether this sort of comfort is good for us. Journalist Leo Kim writes about this for Wired in an article called Deepfakes Can Help Families Mourn or Exploit Their Grief. Leo, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I guess I want to start with this. What sort of digital entity counts as a deepfake?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that kind of fall under that umbrella, but roughly deepfakes use machine learning or deep learning, hence the name, to kind of let users manipulate images or audio. And so you can take a picture of someone, make it look like they're talking, moving, winking, whatever, by training these algorithms on these massive data sets. And these data sets can help them identify human faces as well as the salient features of a human face and let those users map those onto other kind of clips. So you can have a clip of me smiling and laughing and using this tool, apply it to a video or a picture of my friend. And that would apply my motion onto his face and body. And the key idea here is that technology here lets us visualize and hear things that never existed in a really photorealistic manner. It kind of visualizes the imaginary in really convincing form.
And there is sort of a spectrum from simple to quite complex. Talk about, on the simple end of things, the app produced by the ancestry site MyHeritage. What does that do?
Yeah, so that is one of the more kind of rudimentary technologies. They called it deep nostalgia, I believe, where you would upload a picture of a relative, a great-great-grandparent, and it would just kind of animate it so it looked like they were smiling, moving their head, tilting their heads, kind of blinking, bringing it to life in the kind of, you know, Harry Potter portraiture sense, but always keeping it a little constrained.
When you talk about Harry Potter, you're talking about the trading cards they had where the famous wizards of time would sort of act as if they were like a little video on the card.
Yeah, exactly.
So some people love this sort of thing. Some people really don't. What sort of debate sprang up on social media when Kanye West ordered up for his now ex-wife, Kim, a hologram of her dead father a couple of years ago?
Yeah, a lot of the initial reaction was kind of grounded in this kind of uncanny horror or disgust. And I will admit that that's something I felt as well. I think people thought it was kind of creepy. They didn't really know what to think of it. And I think people found it to be this kind of narcissistic exercise, a self-involved kind of ego, you know, playing at God almost, to kind of bring someone back from the dead. And I think that was the kind of major narrative that this kind of act was met with.
Okay, so let's hear a little bit of that.
Happy birthday, Kimberly. Look at you. You're 40 and all grown up. You look beautiful, just like when you were a little girl. I watch over you and your sisters and brother and the kids every day. I am so proud of the woman that you've become, Kimberly, and all that you've accomplished. All of your hard work and all the businesses you have built are incredible. But most impressive is your commitment to become a lawyer and carry on my legacy.
Okay, so just to remind everybody, that is the voice of Robert Kardashian, taken from recordings of Robert Kardashian. Those are words that, to our knowledge, he never spoke in that combination.
Yeah, exactly. It was essentially, I think, a script that had been written and using kind of machine learning and applying that to the audio, like really actually put his voice to the words that Kanye or someone on his team must have written.
It seems understandable that putting words in the mouth of a long departed person would make a lot of people uncomfortable, especially when those words have an ulterior motive. I don't know that there was one in this case, but you could certainly, you know, use the technology to make a dead person say whatever you want them to say.
Absolutely. And I think that these concerns around manipulation are really present. I mean, I think when you hear about deepfakes, a lot of the time we're talking about, you know, the political dangers if you have a political official with a deepfake video saying something that they didn't. But I think even in the case of, you know, people who are dead, you can, you know, theoretically have someone kind of try to alter their will or, you know, leave messages that might kind of fundamentally disrupt the process of grieving. And I think people are very worried about that.
I always love reading things where I start with one take on something and then, you know, you shift me to another take and I'm sort of taken through the process of considering lots of different aspects of this. By the same token, I have to tell you, Leo, I was thinking maybe for some people who missed the chance to have a final important conversation with a loved one, there could be something comforting about this, right? Something along the lines of course, I know you love me, even if you never told me, or I forgive you. I can imagine why people would crave that, even if they know it's fake.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in the grieving process, it's not uncommon to try and, you know, write letters to those who have passed or kind of imagine them with us and say the things that we would want to say. And imagine the things that we would like to hear. And there's this really wonderful full article in the San Francisco Chronicle that looks at a man who used a chatbot trained on his late fiance's old messages to grieve. And he talks about how during his grief therapy, his counselors encouraged him to write letters to his old fiance, but he was never able to get himself into the right mindset for it to feel like he was really saying what he needed to say to the person he wanted to say it to. And this chatbot provided this sort of kind of open ground that he could use to process those feelings that had remained latent for so long. And, you know, he describes it as a really kind of cathartic opening experience. And I think there's a lot of potential in that for a lot of people.
This is also new at the moment that, you know, it tends to strike us as sort of weird and uncanny and just wrong. But you remind us that people felt this way about photography in its earliest days. The Victorians, I know, sometimes called in photographers for last minute photos of dead loved ones, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what I think really surprised me about doing research for this piece was to realize how long this conversation had been playing itself out. And so in the wake of the Civil War, when we were really learning how to deal with death and loss at a mass scale, you know, yeah, you get these photographers who would take portraits of, you know, sitters and using kind of double exposures, like early Photoshop, make it look like there was a ghostly apparition sitting next to them. These were called spirit photographs, and this really let people feel like they were present with those who had died and, you know, were with them currently. And of course, you have the critics who are responding to this, and you get even people like Charles Dickens criticizing the what he calls the narcissistic and kind of materialistic mourning practices of his contemporaries. And, you know, there's a lot of parallels when you look at what, you know, Dickens was saying about the mourning practices of his era and the critics who are talking about Kim and Kanye. There's a lot of parallels in how they kind of situate this within, you know, narcissism and an ego and really trying to prescribe a way to properly mourn. But, you know, when you look back now, I think we're really open to this idea of using photography to kind of mourn lost ones in, you know, the 1800s. And I think something like that will be happening to us in the kind of future as we look back on this moment now.
Were the purveyors of those spirit photographs straight up about the fact that they were manipulating two images and putting them together?
It was hit or miss. I think there were definitely some people who tried to deceive their clientele into thinking that these were actually spirits from the other side. And I think photography then, as now, almost kind of felt magical. You know, you had light and chemicals somehow interacting to produce this image. And so there was this kind of mystical element that I think people were able to kind of leverage and kind of exploit their clientele into thinking these were real, while others were more open about the manipulations. But I think at the end of the day, that the kind of comfort that people were able to find in these material objects, especially at a time when grief was super curtailed, you had really rigid times for how long you could grieve the loss of a spouse, per se. And I think this material kind of artifact let them kind of sit with their loss and sit with their grief in a way that they wouldn't have been able to otherwise.
So, assuming that it's at least possible that deepfakes will follow a similar trajectory, how do we need to be preparing for the day when these might be widely adopted? I can imagine them offered as gifts to some person in mourning, the way today we might copy off and share a treasured photograph or a video of someone who has died.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I think in my piece, I kind of tried to explore a couple of ethical guidelines that I think can help us prepare for this sort of future. Because I don't think we should step into it blindly, and we should certainly contextualize our response on ways that similar technologies have been used and abused in the past. So I think we touched on this briefly in the last segment, but being honest about the artificiality of these images is really important, just as kind of these photographers in the past used kind of double exposures to convince themselves they were portrait sitters were sitting next to ghosts. We should really be sure to avoid that, and you know, figure out a way that we can be upfront about the artificiality of these deepfakes. And I know MIT is developing heuristics that the average person can use to identify these things, but we should look forward to kind of more automated processes. And I think that it really helps to kind of think about what it might mean to create institutions that treat the virtual body like the physical body. Right now, if I want to donate my organs after I die, that's a wish I can make while I'm alive, and that will be I can count on to be respected after I pass. But nothing like that really exists for the virtual body. So you get cases like Prince saying, "Don't bring me back," and it's an open conversation about whether it's going to happen at a Super Bowl. And so I think we need more precedent to figure out, you know, how we want to legislate these bodies as we've done the physical bodies that we have now.
It sort of parallels the process by which we've realized we need to figure out what to do with, like, the social media accounts of people who have died.
Yeah, absolutely. It was after a lot of debate that Facebook started kind of memorializing these accounts. And I think it involved a lot of research into figuring out, were these helpful? Are people using these? And you know, now I think it is a site where people can go to kind of grieve and send messages to those who have passed. But it took some kind of research and actual data to find that out.
How has TikTok already moved into the what you call the curiosity phase of a new technology in terms of like using simple forms of deepfakes?
Yeah, so you know, I think viewed in the context of the spirit photograph, it feels really interesting. There was this phenomenon where users would apply a sort of green screen scan effect to show themselves against like late family members. And by choosing background images featuring their late loved ones, they were able to kind of create new selfies along people who had passed. And people would talk about how it made them really happy to be able to see themselves with their dad because he had missed out on so much and create these almost quote unquote new memories with them. And so people are using the tools that they have available to them, whether it's something rudimentary like on TikTok or more sophisticated like deep learning, to really kind of relate to those who have left.
So the overwhelming sense that you get is that people who make these are making them because they find them comforting, right? They're not necessarily, I mean, nothing would stop them, but they're not trying to make people believe something that didn't actually happen.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's a kind of hard intuition to pull away from. And but I think that most of the approaches at this stage have been really kind of open and genuine. And I think it hasn't got to the point where there's been a ton of, I think, monetized interest in it. And so I think most of the creators who are doing this are either kind of one-off or using tools available to them in kind of new and interesting ways to kind of reckon with their own loss.
There are also machine learning techniques that don't just recreate someone as they were and introduce them into a different image, but imagine how they might have been. Tell us about age-up portraits.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think these kind of stem from technologies that have kind of been used to locate, for example, like missing children, and age them up so you could get a sense of what they might have looked like. But parents who have lost their children early on are using these technologies to kind of think about the what if, and to work through it, and to see pictures of their kids as they might have looked had they made it to 18 or 19 or 20. And I think that critically, these what ifs were always a part of grieving. It's not like this is opening up a new kind of questioning that you wouldn't have had otherwise. What these technologies let us do is really kind of give them a tangible form so you can maybe respond more directly to them or address them more directly. But I think it is a latent desire and thought that we've had for a really long time.
I think that's such a really interesting point, Leo, because, from a distance, especially for people who have not, gone through the experience of losing a child, it's easy to say this is somehow holding you back, and you're sort of carrying this with you by getting these pictures of what someone might have looked like. But almost anybody who's lost someone at a relatively early time in their lives is going to play that game in their heads, however often, if it's once a year on their birthday. I see all the time on social media people saying, my grandma would have been 89 today or something. We do this whether or not we have access to the picture.
Absolutely. And I think having something maybe tangible to react to kind of gives us more to grapple with and more to work through with, rather than, I think the tangibility is something that can actually be really productive when used in the right kind of way.
What are some ways, Leo, that the creators of manipulated images and videos and holograms and whatever form these things might take, how do they definitively let people identify them as artificial? Because, I mean, right now, maybe we can spot some of these with the naked eye, but I would imagine it's a matter of just months or years before it's effectively impossible.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's one of the trickiest things around the kind of this domain entirely. A lot of, I think, what's been coming out has been putting it on the viewer to discern it. So as I mentioned, I think MIT has been developing heuristics that will let just general guidelines on how to identify deep fakes. But I mean, as deep fakes get better with time, I think that'll be something that might go away. And so I think, one, some proposals revolve around actually, straight up legislating that images created in this way be tagged as such. I think that might be hard to kind of in effect use on the internet because of how vast it is and how many images are processing and being created. But it's definitely a major concern, and I don't think that there's been a unified proposal that has really been able to kind of tamp out that risk entirely.
All right, back to the phones. Let's speak this time with Matthew in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Matthew.
Hi there. So the question I have is regarding deepfakes that are representative of the person who died that you're grieving on. Is it possible in the future, do you think, for that to be merged with AI to where you could actually communicate with the screen, like sort of the way we communicate with Siri?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that kind of machine learning technologies can operate at three levels here, and all these things are being developed either in conjunction or in parallel. So on the one hand, you have the visual technologies, which will kind of let someone look like they're moving and talking. You have the auditory technologies, which can take someone's voice and based on, hours of kind of recordings, simulate their voice accurately. And you also have machine learning kind of chatbots and, which can take transcripts and output a response that is similar or in line with what someone would say. And I think it's really easy to imagine a world in which those three technologies are combined in a really seamless way. So it can almost feel like you're having a conversation with someone. I think it'll be a while before that gets to the point at which, anyone is kind of immediately fooled, but it's certainly something that's possible given the kind of technological developments that are happening in these different spaces.
And again, I think about people who sort of continue to have conversations with loved ones who've passed on. Some people go to a cemetery to do this. Some people just sort of do it around the house. This is just an extension of an existing human behavior.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that a lot of the concern here in the push and pull is that we're worried that these deepfake technologies would somehow misplace our affection. that we'd get too attached to the image instead of the actual person that we're losing. And, you know, that this plays out in history all the time. I think, like, religiously, people were afraid of kind of icon worship and, you know, that that would detract from the kind of worship of the deities that the religion prescribed. But, you know, I think in practice, like, I don't think anyone thinks that's going to be the case. Like, I think we will always be able to distinguish between the image and the person. And I think we need to be more open to that possibility because it is, like you said, something that happens all the time.
Are these things expensive to order up? I mean, you know, I hate to keep going back to Kim and Kanye, but they had all kinds of money. Can regular people access this technology at this point?
So the really sophisticated technology that Kim and Kanye were using isn't necessarily available, but I think more rudimentary forms of deepfakes are becoming available commercially. And they're only going to get cheaper as the technology gets better. So I think that what feels prohibitively expensive now, like maybe cameras were in the 1850s or early, you know, 20th century, will kind of go the same way that that technology has. And they'll become, you know, kind of things that any person can really pick up.
There are also concerns that deep learning could reproduce existing cultural, you know, especially racial biases. Lots of people imagine that, you know, technology doesn't have a perspective on these things. Will you talk a little bit about how we can, in fact, maybe without meaning to, load up our technology in the way it works with the same kinds of prejudices that we're trying to eliminate from our own minds and hearts?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and like you said, there is this notion that technology is neutral and it's only the usage of these tools that can be biased. But in reality, it can really creep in at every stage of its development. After all, technology is created by people in a specific culture. And as a result, the dominant assumptions of that culture can really bleed into the technology and impact how it's formed. And so in the case with deepfakes in particular, this plays into the ways that the algorithms are trained. So these machine learning algorithms are trained off of massive data sets. And most of these data sets skew predominantly white and predominantly male, which means that if you have a certain type of face, it'll work great for you. And if you have a face like mine, which is Korean, it might not work as well. And so this could limit access to these technologies for some folks because it just might not work as well. And it could also reinforce views of people of color as uncanny or other if the technology kind of works on them but makes them look a little bit distorted and weird. And it's something that we've seen play out in kind of more common usage in facial filters on TikTok all the time, where you have a lot of creators who are people of color complaining that filters aren't made for them and make them look really unflattering when it's actually supposed to be something that kind of, you know, improves their image.
You can imagine how this might be used in like a history museum setting to, you know, create some exhibits where people get to truly interact with deepfake characters, for lack of a better word, who could sort of represent the ideas the museum's trying to communicate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if there's anything that the separation of kind of COVID and the pandemic has taught us is the value of feeling like you're present with someone. And, you know, I think images can go a long way. I think there's a reason Zoom and FaceTime have, you know, for all their kind of technical faults or improvements that could be made, been such a kind of important pillar of the COVID experience.
And there are pros and cons, of course, to the way that we might be drawn by not just the novelty of this, but by the interactivity of it. I think about how, you know, when a movie version of historic events comes out, lots of people take that as sort of gospel truth and don't necessarily recognize that there's artistic license taken. We might be a little bit more wary of those representations if they came to us through a deep fake representation.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think that there's a kind of natural bit of skepticism that accompanies the technology. And I think that that would definitely be imported into any kind of educational setting if we were trying to use them to communicate with an audience.
Are there a lot of estate lawyers now urging their clients to consider electing what can be done with their image after they've passed on?
It's certainly something that I think is coming up more and more, but I think a lot of these technologies are still at the kind of fringes. And I think that in this kind of space, a lot of it has not necessarily entered the kind of strictly legal domain. I don't think we necessarily have the precedent to really figure out what to do with it yet. And so a lot of the regulation, I think, has been self-policing, because I think the institutions that we have are a little slow to react to these kind of new technologies.
Did you find evidence that tech developers who know how to make these deepfakes are wrestling with these deep ethical questions around them, or are they most concerned at this point with perfecting the technology and assuming that they or somebody else can sort of figure out the ethical implications later?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there does tend to be a tendency where the blinders are on a little bit, where you're focused on the technical problems of the wider context in which it's occurring can be sometimes lost. And I think it's also important to realize that these technologies are being developed in spaces that we really don't want them. Political misinformation, I think that these are technologies that have kind of awful roots in kind of the porn industry. And I think that these are things that we also need to be really aware of when we're thinking about these technologies, because there are the set that refer to specifically grief, but they are connected to a wider web of technologies that are used for far less positive purposes.
I also wonder, you know, sometimes these conversations come up where we talk about, well, why can't we, if only we could all live 200 years, why wouldn't we do that? And there are questions about, you know, crowding the planet and taking up jobs and, you know, maybe we're not meant to live quite so long. I wonder if the ongoing presence, you know, I had a conversation with a music historian recently about the fact that we all love old music so much that it's getting harder and harder for new artists to break in. I wonder if deepfake representations make it harder for sort of new ideas to you know, reach the surface and get attention.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think I saw this article talking about how soon the amount of profiles on Facebook of people who have died will outnumber the ones of people who are living. And so I do think there's this open question about this kind of broader ecosystem of images and information in this era where everything can be retained and remained online. And so there's a lot of noise that comes along with that. And exactly what we want to do with that, I think, is a very difficult question.
Can you imagine ordering a deepfake for someone you care about after they have died?
I think it's within the realm of possibility. I think it's one of those things where I won't personally know how that loss will affect me until it does. But I know that those feelings that I might have to work through are things that I think I'll be very open to technology playing a role in those things.
What about the, you sound like a young guy based on your voice, but have you given any thought to how you'd feel if somebody who cared about you wanted a deep fake version after you died?
Yeah, it is something that I've thought through the course of writing this piece. And I think it would primarily depend on who it was, but I think I'd be very open to it. I think if it provides them comfort, I think that's all that would really matter to me.
Yeah, I guess, you know, in the same way that like funerals are for the living, ultimately, maybe deepfakes are also for and about the living.
Yeah, exactly. I think as much as it's been restrained to this realm of loss and death, it's really, I think, a tool that we can add to our arsenal to help us grieve better and help us grieve productively and open up ways that might not have been available otherwise. Not everyone's going to find it helpful, but I think some people will, and some people are finding it helpful. And I think that's what really matters.
Journalist Leo Kim's article, Deepfakes Can Help Families Mourn or Exploit Their Grief, is available online at Wired. Leo, thanks very much for spending this time with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. You can find the podcast wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think and then subscribing, or you can just go to our website to listen. That's think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.